Welcome to Witchlit, a place to talk about the craft of writing and writing the craft. I'm your host, Victoria Rashke, author, publisher, witch, and nosy Scorpio. Witchlit is brought to you by Thousand Volt Press, a family-owned independent publisher established to produce the books we want to see in the world. Titles including Changing Paths by Yvonne Abreu, Conjuring the Commonplace by Lane Fuller and Corey Thomas Hutchison, A Death in the Dry River by Lisa Allen Agostini, and my most recent book, Verona Green, can be purchased directly from thousandvoltpress.com or wherever you buy books. You can also support the show by buying us a cup of coffee at ko-fi.com/witchlitpodcast. Moss Matai is a pagan, a witch, and a cult survivor. You might know him from his videos on Instagram and TikTok. He's also an experienced public speaker and published writer. He found the path of paganism after being raised in a deeply homophobic doomsday cult. This journey affects all aspects of his practice and is something he regularly speaks about. As part of his personal practice, he draws on the stories of his family home and birthplace, the Harz Mountains of Germany, as well as his Welsh identity. As a Welsh language speaker based in North Wales, he has a deep connection to this magical landscape and the many stories it safeguards. His queer identity is also important to all that he does, being a core part of who he is. Being raised in a homophobic cult, he knows all too well the harm intolerance and hatred can cause. The importance of queer representation is an important theme in all his work, informed by his personal experience. On a no less important note, he's been told he looks a lot like Buzz Lightyear. His first book, An Apostate's Guide to Witchcraft, will be out September 2024 from Llewellyn. Moss Matai, welcome to Witchlit.
Thank you for having me. It's really nice to be here.
It's exciting to talk to you, and I can't wait to dive into the book and just your experience on your pagan journey. But our first question for everybody in this age of Instagram and TikTok and visual media, why write? Why still write books?
That is a good question. Because it mattered, I think. Well, for me in particular, I grew up just before the visual media generation properly kicked in. So I used to get in trouble for staying up at night, secreting books. And then when my parents walked in the room, quickly dropping them down the side of the bed and pretending I was asleep. So ended up, I don't have many books left from my childhood because all the covers ended up getting ruined from being in a pile down the side of the bed and bending in all manner of ways. But I grew up immersed in literature, and I think that was really important to my journey and the way I developed as a person. Oh, my goodness. Oh, my partner would absolutely adore it. He loves cats.
The podcat has joined the conversation because he has to.
Absolutely. Honored guest. Most important guest, I think. But yeah, books were so important to me growing up that from about age 9, I wanted to be a writer. I just didn't know what that would look like in practice. It was one of those dreams that's always sort of in the background, something I'd love to do, but probably never will. Mm-hmm. But it's just such a profound way of being able to share. So short form media is great. And I think it's such an important part of the way we can educate ourselves today. But to be able to sit down and immerse yourself in a topic, or in fiction, to just lose yourself in a world of fiction, mm-hmm. and give that your attention is such a wonderful experience. And I don't think you can lose yourself quite as easily in short form content. It doesn't have quite that same effect. Mm-hmm. So to just be able to sit and be with a subject, be in a world, and to make it something really mindful, I think, is important. And to be able to contribute to that in some form brings me a lot of joy. And I don't think that can be underestimated, really. Just the joy of being able to contribute something to the world of literature in some form.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, that's a really beautiful answer. I'm curious, because you, in the book, you talk a lot about reading fiction and fantasy fiction and Terry Pratchett, bless him.
Yeah.
Especially, did you imagine that your first book you would get published would be fiction or nonfiction?
I think like every aspiring author, I have two or three finished manuscripts in my desk in front of me at the moment that, they must be about 10 years old by this point. And I was sure that was what my publishing journey would look like. Mm-hmm. And who knows, in the future, maybe I'll return to that. But that ended up being something more for me. And that's something I still do for me is to write fiction. But I don't know, I feel like it's a bit scarier putting that out there because you weave, as much as in my book, I directly confront my journey, it's still only in as much as it serves the message of the book itself. Whereas in fiction, you weave so much of yourself into it that you sort of almost can't separate yourself from that work. And putting that out there to me is strangely more terrifying than directly telling my story, if that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah, no, it does. It's, you know, I always compare it to like showing your baby to people.
Yeah.
Like this, I made this. Please don't tell me it's ugly.
No, it's definitely always a little bit of a fear, isn't it? How are people going to respond to the thing you've made?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I think it's interesting. Like one of the things that I really enjoyed about your book, and I feel like this is possibly a little bit more of a trend in a more recent witchcraft books, is that it is very practical in a lot of ways, but you're also telling your story. So it has this memoir aspect to it, which to me, I think is interesting because you can only tell someone what the directions mean so many times, right? Like, I feel like people's personal experience of witchcraft is the thing that makes us completely unique. So obviously you've talked about your experience as a public speaker. So was this book hard to write, to kind of go through that part of telling your story? Or are you enough removed from it that you could do it without?
It was really difficult at points. Mm-hmm. There were points where I just had to stop for a couple of weeks and let it be before I came back to it, especially sort of some of the early chapters. I think chapter two, when I specifically confront sort of life in a cult and how you go about leaving that, that took me so long to write. Not because it was technically difficult, but emotionally heavy.
Yeah.
I think that probably ended up being the heaviest chapter of the whole book. But it's also immersing myself in the stories of others and talking to my friends who've also left high control religions and hearing their experience and finding those points of common ground. Mm-hmm. That was quite difficult, having not just to live my own experience, but to carry the experiences of others to make sure that I was representative, because I think that was one of the biggest challenges, was not just saying, this is how I did it, so this is how other people could do it, but to find what does work more generally for people.
Mm-hmm.
Because I was lucky. I was in a lot of ways very lucky in that I had family members on the outside, and my family after I left also left. And so I had a bit of a soft landing. And a lot of people don't get that. And so I had to make sure I was also accounting for the privileged situation I found myself in, to make sure that I could speak to people who maybe didn't have that fortune. And so that took up a lot of sort of the emotional weight of writing that part of the book. But then there were other bits where I got to dive into sort of, here's maybe the more practical bits. Here's something you can do to maybe put a bit of that shame down, or to absolve yourself of some of that guilt you carry, because that's really pervasive after you've left that environment. And those were such a joy to write that I'd find myself just writing far longer than I'd scheduled to write. So it's kind of that, a bit of a roller coaster, where there were bits where I really did just have to do a little and put it down. And there were other bits where it just carried me through and I got to celebrate the joy of it. And hopefully the end result has ended up being more of a celebration of joy, with the heavy aspects there to illustrate how joyous paganism can be, than something that's heavy throughout, because that's something I wanted to avoid as best I could.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, like you said, there are parts that can be heavy, but you always come back to, but this is where I am now. And this is where, you know, if you are in this situation, this is where you can be too, by example, I guess. It definitely ends on a very joyful note, I think, too. So, like, even as a reader, like when people get the opportunity to read this book, like there are parts that I was just like heartbroken for you in the moment of reading, of just the experience. But then you do follow it up with like, here's this practical way to like use, you know, your new path to find joy out of that situation. So yeah, I think it, I never felt like I have to put the book down and walk away. So, cause I always knew there, like, once you set it up the first time, you got to know as a reader, like you trust you to like, yeah, this is going to be a heavy part, but there's more, I promise. So, yeah. This is maybe a weird question because your book hasn't even come out yet, but I was just thinking like, because you know, in your bio, it mentions, you know, your Welsh and your German ancestry and how you weave that into your work. Like, I think what this book did was whet my appetite for you to talk about more of that.
Oh, that's very good to know. That's exciting. There are things on the radar for the future that I can't talk about in too much depth just yet.
Yeah, of course.
But there are definitely a handful of projects that are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
Because like I say, I adore writing. It's the joy of writing to me is the biggest part of this.
Mm-hmm.
And so to be able to sit with the subject and really just dig into it. So in particular, my German heritage, I was born in Germany. I lived there for a huge part of my childhood. My first language was German. My dad's German, my mum's from Wales. And so to be able to explore those things I was raised with in greater depth in the future is something I'm really excited to do.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not necessarily something that's talked about that often. And it's something that really means something to me. It's such a big part of my identity. So that's definitely something I want to go to far greater depth in,
mm-hmm.
Hopefully in the near future.
Yeah. I don't want to be too spoilery since the book is down yet, but one of the things that really touched me in the book was talking about your dad growing up in East Germany and that, you know, foraging wasn't just like a hobby, like it was necessary to have like variety in your diet and maybe even enough food. And just the idea that now that you two get to enjoy that together, like it's a joyful thing. Like I really enjoyed that part of it. And having spent a little bit of time in Eastern Europe, it resonated with, I lived in Slovenia and it resonated. That's very much a part of their culture too, is foraging. Like the joke is, you know, if you go to a Slovenian's house for dinner, they'll make a salad out of the yard, basically. So,
I love that.
Yeah. But, that part was just fascinating to me. So I feel like there's so many avenues to go from this book. So I'm excited to see what comes next for you. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, in the book, you talk a lot about the community that you found and then built for yourself with first going to the pub moots and then, you know, co-founding this, tradition of the Red Serpent in with your coven mates. And I wondered, like, thinking, because I know that Mara Starling is one of those people, and other folks may know that too if they know you from Instagram. But I was thinking, not only have you found a group of people to practice with, but you have a group of writers as well. And I kind of want to ask how you all support each other in that, because you've all been very busy writing and publishing books.
Yeah, it's really nice actually, because one thing that's really helpful is having access to research material,
mm-hmm.
because one thing that's really important to all of us within the coven is that any information we put out there is good information,
mm-hmm.
because it's so easy to publish something that's just, here's something I've made up, and then that information gets out there, it spreads, and it becomes something that people reference and look to. And that's something we really wanted to avoid. It's Mara's spoken enough about it. She won't mind me saying it's the mm-hmm. primary reason that she became a writer is because of the bad information about Welsh culture that was put out there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was an attempt to address that and to go, no, there's really cool, amazing stuff in this culture. Here it is. So to have access to each other's libraries and research materials, that's a lovely thing. But that's just because I love books. So I love going around to Mara's and just raiding the bookshelves. But then to have that experience to draw upon as well, and to understand the energy expenditure that comes from writing, and sort of have friends who will give you a bit of space after your deadlines and not get annoyed that you're not as present or available, or people who you can go, hey, I've just written this chapter. I don't think it's great. Can you tell me what I can do to fix it?
Mm-hmm.
Or particularly because we're in, by coincidence, a majority queer coven at the moment, when I'm writing on aspects of the queer experience, to have people I can go to and say, here's something I've written about this. Does this resonate with you?
Mm-hmm.
That's really nice, because it can be really scary to put aspects of your identity and experience out there. So to have that little bit of validation from people who will understand where you're coming from is really helpful in putting that out. So it's something I really value. And I genuinely don't think I would be being published if I didn't have it, because it's so key to the whole process for me. And to have a partner who also writes with me means at times it can be a bit annoying, because we have no time for each other other than sat opposite each other at the table typing away.
Yeah.
But also it means having that understanding, because it is a really time and labor intensive thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
So to have a partner who also loves writing, cares about it, is one thing to put good information out into the world, and will also give me the space to write when I need to, is absolutely key to being able to do this journey and live this life.
Yeah. And I think it's so nice to, one, to have someone who understands what writing is like, because you do kind of disappear when you're deep in it, but also just to have other people to go, yeah, you're not losing your mind. You're not, you know, this is what writing is like. Sometimes it works and sometimes it's hard. And sometimes, you know, you just need to go, okay, I can't look at this anymore. Can you tell me why this is not working? Can you see something in this I'm not seeing? But it's solitary business. So it's nice to have folks who you can share that community of solitude with, I guess.
Yeah, it's a beautiful paradox.
Yeah. No, it's a good thing. I mean, when, not that people come to me often for writing advice, but when they do, I always say, you know, writers write. That's the main thing. Just put your butt in the chair. The second thing is, if you can find a community of writers, it will help you be a better writer.
Mm. So. It's having those people as well that you trust to give you feedback, and that they know you'll take it as it's intended.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think sometimes that can be a really scary thing, and it's something I value in the people I trust in my circle, is that they will offer me honest feedback.
Yeah.
Because if you're not open to it and you react defensively to feedback, you're not going to get much of it going forward. But no. It also makes it really scary for other people to offer when you ask.
Mm-hmm.
So to have fostered an environment where the people I care about can critique what I do to make it the best it can possibly be before it goes out to the world at large is something I also really value, because I know how hard it can be to offer that in the first place.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it's important, again, you know, when you have that relationship with other writers, it's really easy to get someone, your friend or a family member, to read your stuff, but they don't want to hurt your feelings. They're going to tell you it's great. They're not going to give you constructive feedback, usually, unless they also happen to be writers. But I think that's, you know, something to look to. And like you said, it's a position of trust, because you're going to do it for each other. So you know that you have the opportunity to say, yeah, this isn't really working. And I always go to the Neil Gaiman, I will butcher this quote, so I will paraphrase it. But basically, when someone tells you something isn't working, they're right. When they tell you how to fix it, they're probably wrong.
Yeah.
So you've got to figure out how to fix it usually. But it's good for someone to tell you this isn't working and this is why I think it's not working. And usually a writer is going to be able better to do that than your mom or somebody.
Yeah, definitely.
So I guess because you have this group of writers and witches, Do you personally, or do you all have rituals around writing? I mean, obviously, if it's something you can't share, you know, that's understandable too, but is there something for you that's like a ritual around your writing?
Yeah, so I have specific things that I use within my writing space that help. So I've got a lantern that I always have a specific candle burning in as I write. Not as the only light to write with, because I think I'd be blind by now, but that's something a little bit symbolic that I've consecrated as part of my writing process. And so while the candle burns, I write. When I finish writing, the candle goes out and it helps. It's lovely. But then there's a few rituals around specific points and milestones of the writing process that we sort of do together. Mm-hmm. So little dedications, invocations, incantations when it comes to places like submitting it and the first draft. There's always a little something we'll all get together as a group and do, and a little points around the journey that sort of the milestones of the project, I guess.
Yeah.
But then one thing that's really helpful that's not quite a practice based around the writing, but it's being able to then write incantations for ritual is a lot nicer when you have a little bit of writing experience. So Mara creates a lot of incantations for our coven. I can't even remember the form of it, but it's the Shakespearean form that the witches speak in, and all magical creatures. So taking cues from literature to create incantations and invocations is really fun. And it helps to create that rhythm, which I think is really important in creating a magical space and a magical energy, and just getting everyone into the mindset of it. Plus, it makes it a lot easier to memorize.
Yeah.
So while that's not sort of directly related to writing, it's a nice way of bringing literature and the written word into ritual indirectly a little bit.
Yeah, no, I love that. And I love drawing from literature personally too. So I appreciate that. I feel like, you know, as much as like, you know, things from grimoires and other people's spells and things like that, literature has its own egregore for me.
Yeah.
So like you're kind of drawing on that too when you are inspired by that for ritual and spells and things. So yeah, no, I love that. Since you brought up submitting, I wanted to ask you, like, what was this process like for you? Because, I mean, like, again, you're in this community of writers, so what was submitting your book like?
Terrifying, to be honest. Especially because it is quite vulnerable and raw in places, and I didn't want to take that out either. I wanted to be very honest and authentic in my experience. The key thing for me was if that can touch someone else and help them stuck in that experience, I need to be vulnerable and I need to be honest and I need to be warts and all, essentially. So submitting that to someone else outside of my circle, so my editor in the first instance, was terrifying to go, okay, here I am, this is me being that vulnerable self, and someone I don't really know is going to read it. That took some doing. But at the same time as well, I was at university when I submitted it. And it was assessment period because I'm really good at planning and I have ADHD. So deadlines were really fun. So I remember the week of the submission was just chaos. So that I think helped because it was like, I've got to get it all done. I've got to get it all done. I've got to click send. And I almost think if I didn't have that pressure, I'd have got stuck on that send button for a lot longer than I did.
Yeah. Oh, no, that totally makes sense. Yeah. Well, and I really admire people who write books for publication in the midst of their higher education. Like, to me, that's a lot.
It was a lot to take on. Idea.
Yeah. Are you finished with university now? Or are you done? Or
yeah, just finished.
Oh, congratulations.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah.
I don't have my results yet, but we will see.
An accomplishment to finish either way. Yeah. So, so now that you're kind of on the cusp of the book coming out, what has that process been like for you?
It's surreal in a way. It kind of feels like limbo at the moment where everything's happening, but nothing's happening. It's a lot of talking to people, going to events, doing things, and sort of talking about the project, but the bubble hasn't popped yet.
Yeah.
And it's lovely because it feels quite relaxed in a way. And there's not the pressure of having to be like, have one of my books just yet.
You can pre-order also, it.
True, which is great. If you want to pre-order, please do. But it's quite nice to have the limbo between the rush of writing it and the rush of it being out and having to go to launch events and doing that kind of stuff. And just to focus on being silly online and doing videos and little TikToks and Instagrams and things, which I enjoy because my little ADHD brain delights in it. And I know, I think it'll be about a month before it comes out. That's when the bubble will probably pop and I'll be like, oh no, I have to do a million and one things to make sure this launch goes as well as possible and to make sure that anyone who could be helped by this project knows it exists. But for now, it's very much, it's not out yet. That's in the future, far away. And I'm just going to keep doing my silly little videos and I'm going to talk to people about it and make sure people know it exists, but I don't have to worry too much yet. Which, yeah, my silly ADHD brain won't let me believe in it until it's imminent.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. And I think I mentioned in our correspondence before we're trying to set up recording time that, like, I've so enjoyed your videos with you and your partner. It's just such a lovely, like, I mean, witchcraft can be serious business, but it should also be fun. And I love that you all really play into that fun aspect of it.
Yeah, absolutely. One of my favorite pieces of pagan liturgy of all time. In fact, I've got it here. So I can read it directly. The Charge of the Goddess by Doreen Valiente, where there's a line in it that I live by. Let me find it exactly. Let my worship be with the heart that rejoiceth, for behold, all acts of love and pleasure are my rituals, and therefore let there be beauty and strength, power and compassion, honor and humility, mirth and reverence within you. Yeah. And it's that last little bit, mirth and reverence within you. You've got these two opposing character values that you have to embody to worship, to do ritual, to invoke magic, really. And I think sometimes people get so caught up on the reverence part of it, they forget the mirth. And to me, witchcraft is all about joy. And joy can be reverent. Joy can be serious. But above all, joy is joyous. And enchantment is so key to magic. But it's not just magic, I don't think. Enchantment and joy are the things that are going to make people want to do paganism, that are going to make people want to do witchcraft. And ultimately, they're going to make people want to protect the environment and treasure the planet that we live on. You're not going to sit someone down, give them a three-hour lecture on why the earth matters. You're going to take them out and get them to dance under trees and build a relationship with them, to care about the grass, to care about the air, and to find joy in it. And once people find joy in that, they're going to want to keep it safe. And so while protecting the environment is an incredibly serious thing, one of the big keys to doing that is joy and enchantment. And so I don't really believe that mirth and reverence are opposing values. I think they exist in exactly the same space and can be embodied in the same space.
Yeah.
And if we want our path to be taken seriously, to me, one of the absolute key ways to do that is show people the joy that's in it. Because if you can find a true reason why you want to walk this path, then you will find any way to do it. But if you don't find that how, you'll leave it behind. And one of the most powerful reasons to me to do it is joy.
Yeah.
That's why it's a big theme in my book, because once you find that joy, you'll never leave the path. It's something you'll want to do for yourself. No one will ever force you. And if you want to step away, that's completely fine. No one's going to stop you. But if you're loving it, if you're finding deep joy and enchantment in it, then it will be fulfilling to you. Mm-hmm. And it will be a path that satisfies that spiritual need you have. So I love making silly little videos and I love doing silly little things because it's just a moment to celebrate and honor that joy, a little ritual of joy. And while it's performative, because everything online is, there's this, it's not true ritual. It's still just a moment to go, look how fun this can be. We don't need to all be in black cloaks in the middle of the forest at midnight, chanting under our breath and being very serious. While that can be fun, sometimes you can just run around under the sun and have a bit of fun and talk about fairies and be in love.
Yeah.
And that can be as much pagan as anything else, I think.
Yeah.
And that's the end of that sermon.
No, I will happily put a soapbox out for you for that. I think it's so true. And I feel like you bring this up in the book and it really resonated with me is that, you know, one of the things about, because I mean, I grew up, you know, obviously in a Christian culture and I grew up in a not very Christian household, but we did go to church and I was a seeker at a young age. So I went to a lot of churches trying to figure out what it's all about. But, you know, as an older person, like figuring out like in college and later that basically we had stripped all of the mysticism and magic out of Christianity was just heartbreaking to me. Mm. Like maybe that's why it never resonated because there, you know, the magic and enchantment had kind of been stripped from it.
Yeah. I think that's something that you can risk doing in any kind of spiritual practice as well. When you become too serious about it, that's not to say you shouldn't take it seriously. I think that's really important. But to be overly serious risks taking that magic out of it and that joy. And then you start deciding that your way is the only way and you've got it right and you've figured out the answers and everyone else has to do it your way. And then you start preaching and then all of a sudden you've become something completely different than when you started your path.
Yeah.
Whereas a focus on that joy sort of respects the fact that however someone finds that is valid for them and their path and their journey. And that there are a million different ways to achieve that. Mm-hmm. And I think that's really beautiful.
Yeah. I also think witches are really good at like kind of poking each other's ego bubbles.
Very much.
Which helps a lot, I think, in that not taking yourself too seriously aspect. So I was thinking about you reading from the Charge of the Goddess, and this is probably a strange segue, but I was thinking, you know, you mentioned that German was your first language and you're a Welsh speaker, and this book is written in English, which clearly you are also fluent in. I mean, if anybody's, you know,
I hope so. I'm not sure, to be honest.
Well, I mean, there's a lot of people who speak English who I sometimes wonder about, but what, I mean, like, I guess, how does that work in your brain? Like when you're creating?
It's really fun. There's a few examples from my childhood with my parents. I will not draw any to mind now because as soon as I want to, they're gone. Yes. But my parents will laugh at me sometimes and they'll remember a sentence I said as a kid where I just swap between the languages seemingly at random throughout. There's one. Dwi eisiau piece of kaiser. I want a piece of cheese. That says way too much about me at 12 years old. that was the first thing I say when I come home from school. But so I was raised in Germany to a German-speaking dad. And my mom spoke German. She'd learned it not long before I was born, but she also spoke English. So I was raised with both languages at home. So my English followed not long after my German.
Right.
And then when we moved over here, I was put into Welsh primary school. And because I had the two languages to draw on, I picked up Welsh very quickly. And also I was about 8 or 9 years old.
Yeah.
So I ended up learning Welsh quite quickly, which was really helpful. I hated it as a child because I had to do it in, you know, a school environment. You chafe against it a little bit. You just want to be rebellious.
Yeah.
And so I was never appreciative of being in Welsh school as a child. Once I left, I'm so grateful to my parents. It's the best thing they could have ever done for me. But it did, when I was very young, sometimes get a bit confusing and difficult for them because they're not Welsh speakers themselves.
Mm-hmm.
But it's, I think, gives a certain depth and richness to the language you then choose to use. Mm-hmm. So I think it helps me be able to write in English because I have the options of the way the other languages express themselves. Mm-hmm. And that sometimes can help with word choices or alternatives, if that makes any kind of sense.
Yeah.
And you can sort of find a depth around certain terms by seeing how they translate or why they don't translate in some instances. And that's something I do really love and go down some fun rabbit holes with.
Oh, yeah, I bet. I mean, I grew up, I mean, you know, in the United States, in the South especially, grew up only speaking English. I took Spanish in high school. And then I went to Slovenia and studied Slovenian, which has no relation to Spanish at all, except the grammar is Latin grammar. But one of the things that struck me as an adult learning a language, which is so much harder, I wish someone had put me into an immersion language as a child, but is that you really start to think about your own language in a completely different way. Mm. Once you figure out how something else is structured. And I've been studying German to kind of reconnect with my German ancestry, and just the overlap between German and Old English that I studied in college has been very weird. Just seems like, oh, that totally makes sense now. But yeah, I think stepping outside of your birth language or your first language totally changes your brain, how your brain is wired around language.
Definitely. And it's really interesting because that example of the German and the Old English is fascinating because, again, for some of those future projects I'm working on, looking at sort of things like the Old English charms that we have and comparing them to things that are done in Germany, like the Nine Herbs charm, which isn't quite Old English. It's Saxon, isn't it? But looking at the way the language and the culture values the number nine in a magical way, and the way that modern cultures still find so much magic in that number and how that matters. And that's really fun. I think that has really helped deepen my personal practice, is being able to look at sources, particularly German language sources, Welsh language sources, English language sources, draw on them and find those commonalities, but also when, where, and why things are done differently.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a massive diversion and detour, so I'll be very brief. But a fun little example is that you've got a type of fairy in Germany called a Kobold, quite famous worldwide, that is often found in mines in the folklore. So you'll find a Kobold knocking in the mines, being blamed for cave-ins, being a bit malicious, mischievous, dangerous to the miners. But then in Wales, you have a type of fairy called a coblin, or coblinai in plural, also found in mines, knocks, but they're benevolent in Wales. They knock on ore to let the miners know where the good ore veins are. So you follow the sound of the coblins. And so you've got these two extremely similar concepts, these two extremely similar entities, but they express themselves almost as the polar opposites.
Mm-hmm.
And being able to look at both and approach the sources for both in the original languages and see they both exist and why they might be different is just fascinating. I mean, we'll never have a true answer, but it's just fun to sit with and think about.
Yeah. I mean, I really think if I had, you know, a different timeline, I would have been a linguist, because I'm so fascinated by those kind of things and how it translates. You know, when you're looking at like broader European culture into Europe, into this idea of Proto-Indo-European, and how that also plays into like the pantheons of different cultures in Europe, and how those overlap and sometimes intersect. Like you said, in one culture, it will be this way, and in the other culture, it will be opposite, even though the names may relate through this Proto-Indo-European stance or something. It's just fascinating.
Oh, I do love it. It's, it's fascinating. Mm-hmm. I could read about it for days.
Yes. Yeah, that is a deep, deep rabbit hole to go down. Oh, so I guess one of the things I wanted to ask specifically for you, and something I ask a lot of folks on the show, is you know, kind of at the end of the day when someone finishes your book, this first book, I'm going to say first, not assuming well, there are going to be many more.
Without giving too much weight, I can categorically say it will be the first.
Good. What do you really hope people walk away from when they're done reading the book?
Hopefully that paganism can be a path of joy, mm-hmm. that it's an option that's open to people who want to find a joyous and enchanting spiritual expression, that there are no hard and fast rules. There's no guidebook you have to follow exactly, that it's a path that allows a deep, fulfilling and meaningful self-expression. And that if you happen to find yourself in a circumstance where that's taken from you or you're deprived of that, that there are ways to escape, that there are ways to get out of highly controlling religious environments, that it's not hopeless. Because one of the big lies that people are told in those environments, that everyone outside their belief system is deeply unhappy, mm-hmm. and that you're then blocked from seeing that. So you just believe it. You believe your way is the only way, and everyone who doesn't do it that way is tragically lost and unhappy. Mm-hmm. So if someone reads that book by some magical coincidence while they're stuck in that environment, if they can see that this is a path that offers a deep joy and a true sense of enchantment, then I'll be very happy.
Yeah. No, that's beautiful. And I think, not reading the book as someone who did not have that experience growing up, like I said, you know, I was never forced to go to church. I kind of went on my own and then was like, it's not for me. But like, I still think there's so many things to take away from it, because we are so encultured in, you know, in North America, in Europe, in this Christian overculture, that we get some of those messages, even if we aren't in those positions where that's all we get.
Definitely. It's such a strange thing, because it's something I've spoken at length about in the coven, because Mara grew up without a religion, essentially. Mm-hmm. She grew up pagan from a very young age, but was never forced into Christianity in any way. My partner sort of flirted with Christianity, but wasn't culturally Christian at all. Mm-hmm. And so, but still, they've picked up on just those expressions in everyday language that are so Christian. Mm-hmm. The overculture permeates everything, from simple things like, oh my God, as an expression, or Jesus Christ. Like, they are inherently Christian things. Or one thing that really surprised me, because I obviously knew it would be an element of my upbringing I carried with me and had to process and deconstruct, but even people who've never been raised Christian, because of the overcultural influences, sort of default to monotheism in their thinking. So mm-hmm. there's this thing where pagans who've been raised pagan but obviously exposed to the Christian way of thinking have the idea that their gods are always watching, or that mm-hmm. there's this one big God in charge and they can only sort of think and relate to one God at a time. And even people who've never been Christian have to take a little bit of time to deconstruct that, mm-hmm. to approach a truly polytheistic worldview.
Yeah.
And that I found really strange, that it's just so culturally pervasive that whether we realize it or not, on some level, it does influence our thinking.
Yeah. And I, when you bring that up in the book, I think it was interesting to me to think about, like, my own, like, how is that, like, ingrained in me? And I think that the gods are always watching thing was a thing I had to figure out. And part of it was coming to the conclusion, and I think you say this in the book too, like, they have other things to do. They're not that, you know, it's not all about you. So, I mean, that to me is like the ultimate, like, poking that ego bubble. It's not all about me. They have other things to do. So
it's fun, isn't it? It's, yeah. But it's, then again, in a Christian worldview, it kind of has to be all about you, because you've got to follow the rules. So someone has to be policing it at all times. Otherwise, what's the point?
Yeah. Oh, well. I am certain between linguistics, I can't even say that word now, my tongue is not working, my lingua is not working, and all of this, we could talk for hours and days. We do try to keep it to an hour.
Very fair.
Yes, but I wanted to give you an opportunity to kind of tell folks where to find your work, what's coming up. Obviously, the book will come out, I think, the week after this airs. So what's on the horizon? Yeah.
A week after this airs, the book will be out, An Apostate's Guide to Witchcraft. So I guess when this airs, it'll be available to pre-order, which if you're at all interested in anything you've heard, you can do wherever you prefer. That's been one of the really exciting things about the journey so far, is looking at sort of the local bookshops and seeing my book available to pre-order there. So mm-hmm. you can support local booksellers or wherever you want to go to mm-hmm. pre-order the book, or wait a week and buy it in person from one of those places, or request to get it in. I'm, as I've mentioned, on all the social medias as Moss Matai or Magic of the Moss. And you're welcome to come follow me and see me being silly online and doing silly little videos, mostly with my partner or my coven. And you can come say hi.
Yeah.
Or I've got a website. I'm all over the place online. If you're in the UK, I try and get to as many events as I can. And so hopefully I can meet you in person as well. And maybe one day I'll be out over in the US too. But the main thing is my book will be out very soon, if you can hear my voice right now. And it would be lovely if you got a copy.
Yeah. And I having read it and experienced it, I would definitely say yes, go pick it up. Even if that has not been your journey, I think there's something to glean from it.
Thank you.
Yeah. So our last question for everybody is a little bit of a game of chance. Ooh, and I always joke that I'm a double Scorpio, so I don't know how to do small talk. Mm-hmm. I always want to ask people, like, what do you think about death? Or what? So we'll roll a die. Then. Yeah. So I'll roll a die.
And six Scorpio placements.
Yeah. Oh, you know then. You know what this is like.
Yeah.
So I'll roll a die. And depending on what I roll, you'll get a question about death, sex, religion, politics, or money. Mm-hmm. And if I roll a six, you get to pick what you want. And you can also pass if you don't want to talk about that.
Okay.
And it's related to your work or, you know, something. I try not to, like, completely left field people. So let's see what we get today. For politics, are you in?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, it's a great time to be talking it.
Yeah, really. Yeah, especially when this airs. It'll be very close for... When are the elections in the UK?
4th of July.
Oh, okay, so they'll be done by the time this comes out, but ours will be on the horizon. Mm. And unfortunately, like the ones in the UK, they don't just affect us. So you mentioned in the book that being a witch, being a queer person, is inherently political. That is just who we are. So what obligation do you think a witch, a queer person, a queer witch has to those around them in the community, however you define that?
I think we all have a massive obligation to each other to create a sense of community in the first place. Mm-hmm. I think that's sometimes something that's lost, is that a community doesn't happen by accident. A community is an act of participation. It's not just something that you can take from. I think sometimes, I mean, I've been guilty of this in the past, of viewing community like a commodity that, mm-hmm. I'm lonely, I need a community I can take from, but without giving to it, it's not there.
Mm-hmm.
So creating a space where people feel safe, valid, and free to be themselves, it's essential. And you can see that as a selfish act, if that's what gets you to do it, because only by creating community will you have it available to you when you need it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's also an inherently selfless thing, because at times you're going to have to give more to your community than you get from it, because that's part of creating it. So creating those spaces where people feel safe, sometimes that's going to be an act of personal sacrifice, but sometimes it's going to be the thing that lifts you up when you're at a point where you have nothing to give.
Mm-hmm.
So particularly in a world where it's so easy to feel hopeless and to feel unsafe, when there are people coming for everyone's rights seem under threat. The queer community on the whole is being subject to incredible levels of homophobia, of transphobia, of every person being targeted because of their identity and made to feel unsafe. I mean, just online, making silly little videos with my partner, the amount of hate comments I get on any video is incredible. But the beautiful thing about it is I can then turn around to my community and go, hey, I've had this horrible experience. Can you hold me for a moment? Mm-hmm. And they do. But that also puts the obligation on me when someone else is suffering to have the space to hold them. Mm-hmm. Because if I can't do that, the community is not there for me when I need it as well. So community is an act of collaboration, and it's something you give to. If community is just something you take from, there's nothing left at the end of the day. So it's that negotiation, that give and take. But it also means that then we're then obligated to take a stand for one another. But even without that obligation, we should just take a stand for one another. But if that's not enough, you're obligated. It's the conversation I have a lot in the coven that, particularly with transphobia on the rise to such an extent, as queer individuals, that's something we should all resist mm-hmm. and stand up to. But there are a lot of, I hope it's not a lot, but it seems to be a lot sometimes when you look online and you see people posting on these various places, a lot of gay people who will side with transphobes and against their own community. And you want to scream sometimes and say, well, who are they going to come for next? You're not safe just because you're siding with the oppressive loud voices at the moment. And you want these people to take a stand out of self-interest, out of going, okay, well, no, I need to speak up for people who are being marginalized because I'll be marginalized next mm-hmm. and there'll be no one to stand for me.
Yeah.
But that should not be the motivation in community. It's not about that selfishness. Even sometimes you just want people to be selfish to get them to care about the people they should care about and to hold the people who are suffering and struggling.
Mm-hmm.
But community is not about selfishness and self-interest. It's about creating something that we all collectively benefit from to keep that hate out and to support one another. Yeah. I think.
Oh, no, I totally agree. I mean, I think about here, the right has really adopted this just transphobic agenda as a wedge issue because they got what they wanted on abortion. So now they're going to talk about trans people. And I'm like, these things are interlaced. Bodily autonomy is bodily autonomy for everybody.
Mm.
And if you're a person who can give birth, you are in the same fight as a trans person to have
Absolutely.
Bodily autonomy. And I feel like so many people, like you said, just don't see that it doesn't stop with one group ever. In history, that's never been true. So,
absolutely. It's why the term queer resonates so strongly with me, because it helps create that community beyond sort of the things that divide us.
Mm-hmm.
The idea of queer community is something I adore. The idea mm-hmm. that all of those people outside of gender norms, of sort of the heterosexual norms of society, that we have more that unites us than divides us, and that we can create that space where we're all safe together and can hold each other.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something really powerful in that.
Yeah.
It puts the obligation on us then to stand up and create those spaces, because they're not just going to happen.
Yeah. Yeah. And when you were talking about that book, it really resonated with me, because I think, you know, as an invisible bi person, like that's always felt like I never felt like I was bi enough or gay enough or whatever to really be part of the community. And I feel like queer makes a bigger umbrella.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you don't have to have like a label slapped on you to say, yes, this is who I am. You can have this bigger picture because you don't have to fit in a particular drawer to be under the umbrella. I'm mixing my metaphors here, but
it works though.
Yeah.
It's lovely.
But yeah, I really appreciated that in the book too, about why, you know, despite, and I think this is especially true of, you know, probably people in my generation, you know, in their 40s and 50s, and then people older than me, that queer was such a barbed, you know, epithet used against LGBTQ plus people, that it's hard to, for some people, it's hard to adopt that word, I think. Mm-hmm. And I try to be respectful of that.
Yeah, no,
but
I totally
agree.
But
to me, it opened a door in a way that just, you know, was really helpful. So,
yeah, no, I'd say I've had exactly the same experience.
Yeah. No, it's. I'm sure we could talk about these things forever.
Absolutely.
Yeah. But I so appreciate your time and your thoughtfulness and your joy and sharing all of that with me and with everybody who's listening. And I hope that people will take that energy and go buy your book.
I hope so. But no, thank you so much for having me. It's been really, really lovely. It's been nice to talk about the book and nice to talk about just things around it as well, and writing and joy.
Yeah.
That's a nice way to sum it up.
Great. Witch Lit is a production of Thousand Volt Press and is edited by Julian Rashke. Our intro music is Cosmic Glow by Andrew Kay, and our outro music is Voices by Alexander Shinekar. Transcripts and all our previous episodes are available at witchlitpod.com, and you can follow us on Instagram at witchlitpod. Please help other witches find us by leaving a rating or review wherever you listen to podcasts. Thank you for listening to and reading Witch Lit.